Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi every day in the supermarket, but what is beyond the sushi? We hear dashi, ramen, izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. My guest today is Guy Allen, a sushi blogger based in New York City. Guy fell in love with sushi at a very young age and has been exploring the world of sushi globally since then. And you can find his discoveries on Instagram under the Sushi Guide. His reviews are so unique and fascinating, and his photos are so stunning that he has been invited to dine at great sushi restaurants in Tokyo. So today we'll discuss Guy's diverse experiences at sushi restaurants, his criteria for great sushi, why sushi is universally appealing to diners of all ages, and much, much more. But before you start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Now, let's start a conversation with Guy Allen. Hello, Guy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Akiko.
So I've been excited. It's hard to imagine you went to Japan. You're invited to dine at the great sushi restaurant, which we're going to talk about in a moment. But first, to get to know you, where are you from? And what did you eat when you grew up?
Sure. Yeah, it was an exciting trip to Japan. I went just last month, and I'm planning another trip in the fall of 2023. Like most people, I hadn't gone for many years because the country was closed due to COVID. So now trying to pack in as many trips as I can. But I am from the New York area, and I still live now in New York. So I've been here for most of my life. And growing up, I definitely ate a lot of sushi only because my parents are very into the food. And I think in general, people who grow up in this area, I think, are more into sushi than other parts of the country. I think because the suburbs of Long Island and New Jersey and Westchester and Connecticut, there seems to be a lot of sushi restaurants that have been around since the 90s. So people from my generation really love sushi. All my friends eat sushi. Most people I know appreciate it, maybe some more than others, but it is a very popular food and has been for many years on the East Coast.
I keep hearing the sushi quality in New York is really, really high, and probably they say the best of the world outside Japan. So, yeah, we'll talk about it. So when and how did you get into sushi? Like, you know, you said your parents loved it, but do you have any rough age that you really personally started to love sushi?
Yeah, I think in probably my early days, when sushi started to get really popular here in New York is around 10 years ago. I think up until then, New York was like most big cities, American style sushi, a lot of rolls, a handful of high quality restaurants that you would maybe go to on special occasions. But 10 years ago, places started to open at a very rapid pace. And now we're at a point where omakase and very high quality omakase is kind of the norm. The expectations and the bar has been set really, really high, because over the last 3-4 years, a new restaurant opens in New York almost every week or two. So we now have over 100 omakase restaurants in New York City. And if you looked at that number 10 years ago, it was probably 10 restaurants. So I started really to get into it. I think also around this time, because I just had more exposure to it. I was able to try new things, be exposed to this higher quality. And at that point, I wanted to just continue to try more, go to more restaurants, do more traveling, and eat more sushi.
Right. Well, you mentioned the rolls, but, you know, some people were talking about edamame sushi, which is rice, tiny piece of rice topped with fresh cut, fresh raw fish. So, and some people are scared of eating raw fish even. But what do you think is the key point of sushi as food? Like, why do you like sushi so much as a food?
I think it starts with liking seafood in general. I think anyone who loves or has the ability to love sushi, I've always been into all seafoods, cooked fish, shellfish, shrimp, lobster, everything. So I love seafood to start, but sushi in particular, and especially, like you said, edamame sushi is very, very special because, one, it's a very simple food. It's very healthy. And I guess for me personally, I really like the art form, and there's a certain appreciation of what it takes to create this food. You know, when you go to a really high-end sushi restaurant, I've talked to so many chefs over the years, and I've done a lot of research and reading about exactly what goes into making one piece of nigiri. This very simple bite, which is, like you said, and a little bit of raw fish, is an incredibly complex and expensive and skill requiring technique. And it's because I know what goes into it, it's just very special when you go and have this food, because it's not something that you can make. I think that's one thing that separates sushi from maybe any other food besides like extreme molecular gastronomy, which is you can't just make it. Even if I had the skills, which I don't, none of us do. Even if I had the skills to make this food, it would cost so much more money to make an equivalent omakase meal in my home. So you can't just do it yourself. Unlike, you know, good Italian food, you can create a recipe, good French food, other most cuisines, you can find recipes and create amazing foods in your home. You can't do it with sushi. It will just never be as good. So it's unique in that way. You have to go to a restaurant and dine with these great chefs.
Right. Yeah, it's you know, like the film Jiro Dreams of Sushi really describes everything. It's more like way of like judo, kendo, like spirituality included. So it's not just like looking at a recipe you can reproduce, and I've never tried myself. Yeah, and then you said the art form. So you studied your Instagram blog about 5 years ago, which is, you really captures beautifully these forms of art. So why did you start the Instagram?
I think mostly because I've always been into photography. At the time, there were, I think 5-6 years ago is when these food blogs on Instagram and online started to really take off. And at the time, there were really only a handful of high-end pages. Most of them were not in the United States. Most were in Tokyo and Japan. There, at the time, there was only one in New York City that was like that featured high-end sushi. And so I just thought I could bring my own perspective and at the same time, let me try different restaurants. Let me, use some of my photography hobby that I wanted to use on something. And so I think if I looked at the sushi world today, I probably wouldn't even try to start it because there's so many food blogs. There's so many sushi blogs, but 5 years ago, that wasn't the case. So there was just like an opening where someone like me could go and maybe just share good pictures with the world.
Well, actually, I'm looking at your Instagram photos and it's just stunning. And of course, the camera quality and smartphones and everything becomes really improved. That
exactly.
Right? So it's amazing. It makes me so hungry right now. So how often do you go to sushi restaurants?
At this point, I'll go usually once a week. I think pre-COVID, I was going twice a week. And that still is the case once in a while. The most I'll do is three, but once is kind of the norm. Yeah. And a lot of times it will be a new restaurant that opens up. I'll try to help the new chefs and take some good photos for them and put up a review and kind of tell New Yorkers what the newest omakase bars are so people can just be aware because there are so many now. And I like helping these chefs and restaurant owners kind of reach the right people.
Hey, and how do you choose the restaurants to review?
So typically, if there's a new restaurant where either I know the chef or the chef was referred to me from someone, another good chef that I know, I'll try to go to all the new omakase bars. Again, just because I like helping the new restaurants. They actually need this kind of exposure more than anyone. So if it's a new place, I'll always give them a shot. And obviously, if the food is good, I'll always give a very positive review. And then besides new openings, I have kind of a rotation of chefs that I really like, restaurants that I've liked for many years that I'll go to, every few months or so.
Right. And so what are the criteria of good sushi restaurant for you?
For me, I am more concerned about food quality than atmosphere and vibe and decor. I think some people really value that, especially if they're paying, $200-$300 a meal. People want that sort of experience, which I totally get. I think I'm the same way sometimes, but to me, the food is the number one criteria. I personally have an affinity for a more traditional kind of menu, edamame style. But there are so many different styles in New York now that I enjoy them all. I think it's really interesting to try different ones out because there's definitely a variety.
Right. And for example, people really choose like a basic hamburger. The classic burger is the criteria of good burger place or something like that. So when it comes to sushi, what ingredients do you use as a criteria to evaluate the quality of sushi?
I think typically if chefs use mostly Japanese fish, that's usually a good sign. I also give extra bonus points for chefs that get a little bit more creative than, the standard nigiri. For example, if a chef has four tuna pieces in a 12-course menu, I think that's not as inventive as some of these other chefs that like to use different types of smaller hikarimono silverfish and chefs that take the time to use more difficult fish like kohada, like saba, Hokkaido crabs, for example. It just comes down to ingredients. I think there's a lot of good local fish as well. Like, for example, New England and Boston have very good tuna, very good scallops. So it doesn't all have to be Japanese or foreign ingredients, but typically, if you're using a wide variety of fish, the best ones are in Japan. So that's always a good start if the chef is using those.
Yeah, personally, I like kohada because it's a gross fish, and I keep changing the name as they get bigger. And then kohada is the second. It's like 7 to 10 centimeters, which is like, you know, 3 inches. And really shows chef's preference, the style, and also the balance of salt and vinegar. And whenever I go to Japan, especially, kohada is always something I test with. And I think it's good to have certain, fish. Whenever you go to, as listeners go to this restaurant, Akami really reflects how they source good tuna and all those things. So I really think it's a good idea to have favorite piece of fish that you always order. So anyways, so.
Yeah, totally. I totally agree. Yeah, I think kohada is a good one to use as like a barometer. Obviously, it takes a lot of skill to make it right. So if a chef is presenting a really good kohada or even other silverfish, I think that really shows that they've been doing it for a long time. They really know the craft.
Right. Okay, so we'll take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll dive into some of the most fascinating restaurants Guy has reviewed. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. The knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Corin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view the exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Corin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit corin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats on HRN, Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Guy Allen, a sushi blogger based in New York City. You can find his discoveries on Instagram under the Sushi Guide. So just let's continue the specific part of sushi, how it's made. So chefs are crazy about their sherry or rice recipes. And sushi rice is made with premium grain rice and vinegar, sugar, and salt and water. So it's simple, but sushi rice flavor can be very different. And it's very important to determine the quality of sushi and the quality of chef. So what types of sherry have you seen, and what is your favorite type of sherry?
Yeah, good question. The rice is very important. I don't think it's well known in the States, the hierarchy of the sushi ingredients. And it's something that I also learned not that long ago when I started getting into sushi and researching. But I think most people are surprised to hear that the rice is actually the more important ingredient when you talk to chefs, even when you talk to most sophisticated diners. The rice is the most important ingredient, and then the fish is secondary. And so it really all starts there. And so I personally like akazu, which is, I think, the preferred style for most edamame chefs. It has a little bit more bite. And that's been the one that's most frequently used for a lot of new restaurants in New York. I know in Tokyo and Japan, it's also very popular.
I agree. Akazu means a red vinegar. And apart from regular rice vinegar, which is based on, you know, the regular fermentation, but akazu is made with sake leaves, which naturally includes more umami. And it gives a nice red color. So, yeah, that's my favorite too. And I think on your Instagram, And there's one Akazu that's a sushi mumi in New York City. I think it shows a beautiful Akazu rice. So if listeners want to see what that got.
Yeah, that's
right?
Correct.
Akazu rice is just so.
That's a good example of, they just opened, I want to say a month or two ago, a very new restaurant. The chef there trained at Sushi Ginzo Nadera, which is one of the highest end restaurants in New York. They've been around for a very long time, and their chefs are typically Japanese trained, and that's where this particular chef learned that to use that type of vinegar, because the very experienced Japanese chefs at Ginzo Nadera, that's how they teach. That's their style. And at Sushi Mumi, they're using the same techniques.
Right. And so now I'm sure our listeners' burning question is what your favorite sushi restaurants are. So can you share your thoughts with listeners?
Yeah, that's probably the most common question I get. A lot of people ask, what's your favorite place? I have a birthday. Where should I go? I think it's really an impossible question to answer, because I think sushi, unlike other cuisines, has so many different styles that my personal favorite place will definitely not be the same for a lot of and I'm a student of kind of the sushi industry myself. I'm always asking people that I respect what their favorites are. And once a year or so, I'll do a poll. I'll ask, 30, 40 people from all over the country that I know are very knowledgeable in the sushi kind of world, what their favorites are. And I get a lot of different answers. And so I know that everyone has their own preferences. So I would say, for example, if you really like rich, fatty tuna, some people love tuna specifically, you'll ask them their favorite. They might say their favorite chef is Ichimura, who specializes in aged tuna. He has a lot of special chutoro and otoro pieces that are like his signatures. If you happen to like Hikarimono, you might say your favorite place is Nakaji, which is in Chinatown, a very, very traditional restaurant. And his specialty are the kohada, are the sabas of the world. And he comes from his entire family are sushi chefs. His dad was a sushi chef, grandfather. So he's learned very old techniques for making Hikarimono. So a lot of people say that is their favorite. I've heard people say that their favorite is Naz, Sushi Naz on the Upper East Side, because it has a little mix of all of these different features, and they also have a very classy and traditional Japanese style omakase bar. The interiors and decor are very beautiful. Some people care more about that. And so I personally actually don't even have a favorite. I would say if I'm in the mood for one particular type of sushi or another, I'll on any given night like that. But I don't think there is an answer for what's the best sushi restaurant. Even in Tokyo, where I just came from, I also asked a lot of people who visited the top restaurants, what their favorites are, and everyone has a different answer, because again, every chef has a slightly different style, and it really comes down to personal preference.
Right. So your answer, I think, is the perfect answer.
Yeah. There's no answer, and I do think it's very difficult to compare the really high end, expensive sushi restaurants to something more middle end. If you're going to pay $500, $600 for a sushi meal, it's a little bit difficult to compare that with something that's $150, which can also be very, very good, but it's just not going to be at the same level when chefs are paying for the very best uni at the uni auctions, when they're paying for some of the best tuna from Tokyo to be flown to New York. But you know, if you ask someone what their favorite is, they might tell you that they would rather spend $150 and get very good quality than spend $500 and get, you know, something a little bit better. But it kind of, yeah, it just kind of depends what people prefer.
Right. And even, you know, the sushi and fish itself also, but also chef really customize their own soy sauce, the sweetness, and depending on which neta to the fish, they change the soy sauce and all those details. And also even the temperature of sherry, the rice. It's so many things that you can compare, and you can just, something that hits you, you have to remember because it's so special. So yeah, it's a very profound.
Yeah, that's correct. A lot of variables, exactly.
Right. Okay, so now let's talk about your amazing experience in Tokyo. So you were invited to dine at the famous sushi restaurant in Tokyo called the Sugita. And first of all, how did you get lucky to be invited to this place in Japan you invited? And then you eat sushi at one of the most difficult sushi restaurants to get a seat.
Yeah, good question. I was invited by a tour company, a very special Japanese food tour company called Plan Japan. They happened to have a last minute cancellation for one of their spots, and they invited me, and I booked a ticket just a few weeks beforehand because it's really a once in a lifetime type of experience. As you know, it's essentially impossible to book the top restaurants there. There are no reservations available to the public at this point. They really only allow insiders and former diners to go. So this very special tour company, again called Plan Japan, they have relationships with basically every top sushi restaurant in Tokyo. It's a very unique situation. The founder there is just extremely well connected, and so yeah, they invited me in November. And so I went, it was just about a month ago.
Wow. Sounds like you lived a dream for a couple of weeks, or like a week.
Yeah, I was there for a week. I mostly went for this restaurant, Sugita, but I hadn't been to Japan for a few years. So I made it a full week in Tokyo. And so I basically made it my mission just to eat as much sushi as possible. And that ranged from, you know, Sugita, which is considered the top restaurant in Japan, to, you know, $10 standing, you know, sushi lunch spots. And so when I go there, I like to get a sense of the entire gamut of sushi in Japan. It's not just that these super high-end, very exclusive restaurants exist. And they are incredible. But to me, what's more, I think, more impressive with sushi in Japan is the quality of the lower-end sushi, is the quality of the middle-range sushi. And it's really mind-blowing what goes on there with sushi that costs $10, $20, $30, and how good it is. It's unreal.
Right. I mean, if you go to regular, like very, very regular supermarket, they sell tons of sashimi quality fish, and it's the access and the mindset, the fishing culture and everything. So they can make sushi very accessible, and their quality is extremely high. So yeah, I totally agree. So what kind of sushi restaurant is Sugita, and why is it so famous?
It is a very traditional, very minimalist omakase bar. There's 8 seats. The chef focuses on using the simplest ingredients. He doesn't use any toppings. The pieces are quite large. His nigiri are, you know, maybe 1.5 times the size of what we see here in the that's just his personal style, but it's very, very basic. Even his appetizers, it will be 1 or 2 ingredients, and that's it. You know, one example is he'll serve a Hokkaido oyster, and some grated ginger. And that's it. He lets the ingredients speak for themselves. He doesn't overwhelm. There's not a lot of soy sauce on the nigiri because he's very well connected with the fish market. And so he gets the premium fish. The best of the best in Japan go to his restaurant. So he likes to let the fish quality speak for itself. The rice is essentially perfect. And if it's really a special place if you like that kind of style, really traditional. It's a very special place. Again, mostly because you can't just go. I mean, just to be able to go once is for someone like me, like an opportunity of a lifetime. So I'm grateful to have gone and to try it. And yeah, it's beautiful in its simplicity. It's on this very quiet, unassuming street in a residential neighborhood. You know, it's not amongst the other fancy Ginza omakase bars that so many people know. It's kind of off the tracks a little bit. Very quiet, very, very beautiful. It's what you imagine when you think of like a old school sushi restaurant. Not a lot of flair, just extremely, extremely high quality.
And I heard a chef goes to the Toyosu market every day, first thing in the morning. And that's really like commitment. So yeah, what kind of a price point are you talking about at his place?
So they charge currently 40,000 yen. And because of the exchange rate, that only comes out to today for at $280. So that's another thing that's pretty special. So if you compare that price, that's $280 including tip, which would be the equivalent of, let's say, a New York restaurant that is, you know, $220, $230. Because here you do pay tip. In Japan, you don't. And that's pretty unbelievable because in New York, $220, $230 is not even the highest price tier anymore. So it's not that expensive. I think I've seen that in general in Japan. The food overall is cheaper than in New York, but especially the sushi, even the highest end restaurants who can charge whatever they want. Honestly, I think they could charge over 1,000 and people would still go. There's a handful of these restaurants that are so exclusive and so special. They'll no matter what, but they don't charge $600. They don't charge $1,000 like Masa. I don't know the reason why. I assume it has to do something with accessibility. Maybe there's a humility there where they feel, you know, awkward charging so much money for sushi, but it's very different. You know, in New York, we have the most expensive restaurant in the world, not just sushi restaurant, but restaurant overall. Masa is $950 a person now because they've been raising their prices for so many years. It's an insane price. It's really something else. Yoshino, which is the second most expensive, they just raised their price as well to $650. There are several others that are $400 and above. So they're... The prices in New York are only getting more and more expensive because, you know, New Yorkers are willing to pay. You know, it's someone's birthday every day, so people go for special occasions. But in Japan, the food overall, but the sushi is so much cheaper. It's a very stark contrast.
I agree. The food is very democratic in Japan. I think the mindset is that you have to be fair. Otherwise, I mean, restaurants last for 10, 20 years. That's not rare. That's almost like normal. So you can't be, unfairly pricing everything without justifying, explaining, because it's a long-term relationship about everything. I think there's a mindset, like in employment. It's a trusting relationship. And I hear like some sushi chefs do not even ask the price to, you know, the Toyosu market vendors, because that's a relationship and you trust. They don't charge you anything crazy because of the built in trust in the relationship. So yeah, and I'm a little concerned about this New York City crazy, like 450, that's reasonable. And if it's under 300, oh, it's pretty reasonable for sushi. And that's not democratic. And I want everybody to be able to taste that amazing art form like you described earlier. So I have a concern about this ridiculous pricing of sushi in New York. So yeah, I hope something is going to change. Maybe the recession may change it.
From what I've seen, it's only going the other way. So I keep a list of all the sushi restaurants and the prices, and the last, you know, few months, every other day I have to go in and change the price because most places are increasing the prices. One, I think because fish prices are up, and especially during COVID, a lot of these restaurants didn't do so well and they're trying to make up for lost time, which is certainly understandable. But I think the standard for what middle range used to constitute is different. Today, anything under 200 is considered affordable omakase, I think. Certainly anything under 150. When I really started to get into this, like 10 years ago, 9 years ago, my favorite restaurant was called Ichimura at Breaststroke, which was an omakase bar in Tribeca. And I remember that started at $150 per person. And in my mind, that was the best place in New York. They eventually raised their price to $200 per person. But again, that was, you know, maybe the top place in the entire city. Today, you know, everything is double that. So prices have drastically changed over the last few years, for sure.
Right. Let's hope for something better. Silver lining upcoming New Year.
I think the silver lining is there are so many restaurants, and there are a lot of affordable ones. That we're very lucky. New York has this much high quality sushi in one. It's very special.
Right. And also the distribution system has been improving. And also I think Western restaurants started to use that same quality of sushi for their known sushi items. So yeah, I think the infrastructure for sushi is really, I think, top of the world in New York.
Yeah, that sounds right.
So anyway, so there are many. And, you know, like we talked about this fancy sushi restaurants. And to me, to be honest, it's kind of intimidating to go to those places. So what are the rules for yourself to be a good guest at the sushi restaurant? And any tips for good manners as a sushi diner?
Yeah, it is intimidating. I guess it depends on the chef. Like when I went to Sugita, since it's my first time there, I don't quite know the chef's preferred behaviors. I think different chefs are either more talkative with their customers, they're more tolerant of different requests than others. Some chefs are, you know, I do things my way, and if a customer decides to ask for something a little bit different, they feel offended. Some chefs don't care. They'll, you know, you can ask them to change whatever. And so I think it just depends on the individual chef. For me, if I go to a new restaurant where I don't know the chef, I just like to ask a lot of questions so that I understand what exactly they feel is appropriate. I don't want to overstep. And so, if a chef, for example, is using really large nigiri and I want them smaller, I'll ask. I'll say, "Hey, chef, do you think it's possible to? I don't mind if you keep it your way, but you tell me, just so I don't insult the guy." So it's just about asking questions and trying not to impose your. These chefs have been working at their craft for years, and they also have their way they like to do. I like to let them for the most part, unless there's something egregious that I need changed. Like, for example, you know, if a chef is using just way too much wasabi, I'll ask. I'll say, hey, do you mind if I have a little bit less? Most chefs are, I think, they're open to hearing what their customers want. So it's typically not a big problem, as long as you're quiet and you ask respectfully.
Right. And also, I think typically people say sushi chefs want you to eat sushi. Even if you're talking, it's like eat at the peak flavor and freshness. So if it's served, you eat it right away rather than leaving it like 5 minutes.
Exactly.
Right, exactly.
That's that's like the number one rule, even though I often I break that rule because I take so many photos. But the chefs are usually understanding because of the, you know, photography is a little bit different.
Show your appreciation by taking beautiful pictures. So I think.
Exactly.
And also, one of my chef friends, he said, well, somebody asked, I like otoro. So I'm going to have 10 of those. And it's not respectful to other guests because they have only limited supply. And it's not like going to steakhouse, keep ordering big steak. It's just you allocate per, you know, the turn of the table. So you can't do that. It's like a respect to other guests. That's why he told me. It totally makes sense to me.
Yeah, it's also respect for his menu. You know, he crafts his menu from different fish. The expression matters and the variety matters. And asking for one particular one, it almost defeats the purpose. So I totally understand that.
Right. Like you're right. So this is the flow of the flavors. That's like French course menu. There is the flow of from white fish to more kind of color, deeper colored fish. That's very well kind of coordinated, designed like any chefs.
Yeah. And it makes a big difference in how you enjoy the meal. So That progression, the way different chefs choose to serve one fish after another, sometimes they'll do, most of them do the white fish first, going off into deeper, richer red fish. But sometimes they switch it up and, you know, that's a very purposeful thing. And again, that's one of those style questions. Some people really like certain order of how fish is served. There's a traditional way, there's other ways, and, you know, depending on your preference, some people will just have a better experience with one chef versus another, just based on the order of the fish.
Right. It's the best thing is to follow chef's creation, and that really maximizes your experience, I think.
Yeah.
Right. I'm getting hungry, but there are many great sushi restaurants outside of Japan lately. So, and we have global audience. I mean, the worldwide, well, Japanese are like 190 countries listeners. So what city or cities outside Japan are most notable in terms of the Korean sushi restaurants now?
I think most of the big metropolitan centers have a really big focus on sushi these days. I mean, New York, just for being so small, area-wise, having over 100 omakases, I think, is notable. There's just a density there. Also, New York seems to be a place where certain very respected Japanese chefs are starting to come to open up new restaurants, unlike, you know, other closer Asian cities. For example, Yoshino, New York, opened last year, and Yoshida-san is an extremely respected 3 Michelin star Japanese chef. And when he decided to leave Japan, he chose New York. Nakazawa-san from Sushi Show, who opened his restaurant in Hawaii several years ago, he's also moving to New York next year, as opposed to going back to Japan or some other big country or big city in Asia. So I think looking at New York as a place where they can really thrive. But honestly, Hong Kong has always been a huge sushi city. They have, I think, as many or more omakases than New York does. The quality is extremely, extremely high because they can also get the Japanese ingredients very easily. But a lot of Asian cities, like, you know, Bangkok, for example, is not a place you would think is being a big sushi place. Thailand is a place where a lot of people from Japan go to vacation, and a lot of people live there as well. And so Bangkok has an amazing sushi industry, ranging from extremely high-end Michelin star omakases to kind of local donburi restaurants that are very, very high quality. Same with Singapore, even though it's just much smaller. But in the United States, the last 3, 4, 5 years, we've seen an incredible increase in high-end sushi restaurants. And I decided to write a book just so I can highlight all of these different amazing restaurants that have started in the last 6, 7 years. And I'm publishing it actually in 2 weeks. And the way I structured it is New York, San Francisco, and LA have their own chapters because each of these cities has just a tremendous number of restaurants. New York has the most at, I think it's 102 restaurants. LA has around 70, and San Francisco is also getting up there. I can't remember the exact number, but the Bay Area, they have amazing sushi as well. Mm. And then I have a separate chapter for kind of the rest of the country, which includes, you know, Miami has, let's say, 10 really good places. Chicago has a handful. Philly has one. There's a high-end sushi restaurant in Omaha, Nebraska now. Portland, Oregon has high-end sushi. Charlotte, North Carolina. So, I mean, Atlanta as well. Every single city, I think, in the U.S. has at least one high-end place because omakase is just getting so, so popular. But around the world, yeah, Paris has fantastic sushi, London as well. And so I think because of the popularity of high-end omakase and because there's demand for it, I think Japanese chefs and high-end chefs see that consumers are willing to pay and spend really high prices for these experiences. So chefs from Japan will travel to, you know, Australia. They'll go to London and they'll open their own restaurants, and it's just spreading like crazy. There's amazing sushi almost everywhere at this point. South America, Brazil has amazing sushi. Mexico City has really good sushi. I was there last summer. It's really everywhere.
That's amazing. And also, what's the book, the title of the book? I'm very curious.
Actually, it's funny. Maybe you can help me. I'm deciding between two titles. It's the last thing that we're still figuring out before it goes to print. I'm thinking my original thought was Sushi in America, the top restaurants and chefs. I might go a little bit more simplistic and just title it Omakase. And so I'm still figuring it out. What do you think is better?
I think Omakase. Hey, hands down. My personal, because you don't limit by naming America. You're limiting by the imagination of what you could see in the book. I think Omakase, I think you have a lot to say about Omakase concept rather than just restaurants in America. So that's my...
But this particular book it's basically of the top restaurants in the United States. So that's actually the point of this particular book. I would like to do another one maybe next year that includes more countries. But for now, I wanted to highlight the top places in the U.S. Mm. There's so many, and a lot of people ask for these lists. There are no resources for, you know, top restaurants in different cities. So this was partly because people asked me to do this and partly because it's just a fun project.
Right. So here you go. You have the first book named America and then your second one, Omakase. So you have your resolution for next year.
Perfect.
Right. Yeah. So do you have any plans, like, you know, which restaurant you're going to visit or any plans for the new year and beyond?
I had sushi last night, actually, at one of my favorite places in the Upper West Side, which is called Takeda, a very traditional restaurant. I probably won't have, actually, I'm going to visit a new restaurant, I think later this week. And another omakase restaurant opened in the West Village last week. So I'm going there to check it out and take some photos. Besides that, nothing's on the horizon, I think, for new restaurants for the next few months, but I'm sure a few will pop up. But in terms of plans, I'm actually starting to plan out the next Tokyo trip, which will be in next November. But you really do have to, do this in advance. If you want to go to some of the top restaurants or even a lot of the high-end middle quality restaurants, you have to book them really far in advance. So I'm starting that process today. Mm. You have to do it early. Right.
Sounds like a fun process, and you can look forward to it so much in advance. So yeah, good luck.
Yeah, it's fun. It's a little intimidating just because, as I'm sure you know, what's incredible about Tokyo and some other cities there is the sheer amount of high quality restaurants is almost mind boggling. It's almost like, you know, when someone describes the universe to you and they say there's an endless number of galaxies and stars and there's no end to it. That's how I think about good sushi in Japan. You know, if you try to do some research on picking, you know, if you want to pick six restaurants or five restaurants to go to in a 2-week trip, or a week-long trip, it's very difficult. There are so many. And so it's intimidating because you don't want to miss out on you know, potentially some incredible place. And if you haven't been before, you know, sometimes you have to rely on other people's reviews and opinions. But it is very fun.
Right. Well, sounds like you have a lot on your plate. So, yeah, good luck. And so listeners, just go to your Instagram, the Sushi Guide, or do you have any other online presence?
Yeah, right now it's just the Instagram. It's the Sushi Guide. I plan on releasing these lists for the top sushi restaurants on a website, which will also be called the Sushi Guide, but that probably won't be live until maybe the end of January or February. But yeah, the idea is just to give people a little bit more easy access to find all these different restaurants in different cities, not just New York. So the website will be coming up, and I really enjoy, you know, documenting the rise of sushi because it's just growing and growing every single day. More and more people are, you know, learning to appreciate the really high-end sushi restaurants and chefs, and it's fun getting to experience it and showing people and also helping chefs. I really enjoy helping new chefs who are, you know, starting out. A lot of these guys are younger and you know, they're going out on a limb and starting their own businesses. Restaurants are difficult as it is, and I like being in a position to be able to help these guys just reach more people, because when there are, you know, hundreds of restaurants, sometimes really good ones can get lost through the cracks, and that happens sometimes. So I'm always trying to find kind of the underrated, the low-key places that more people should visit.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you are really an ambassador of the sushi industry. So
yeah, that's a good way to put it. I like it. Ambassador.
Right. So you're going to post your new book on the Sushi Guide on Instagram too when it's ready to come out?
Yeah, I'll in the next week or so I'll post you know, some of the highlights, some photos, but you know, I want people to be able to at least get it before the new year. And yeah, it's a really exciting project. I think it's the first kind of list of its kind to document all of the top places in the various cities, not just one city or another. And so it's definitely exciting. A lot of chefs have been really helpful in showing me their interiors and telling me about how they create their nigiri and their sourcing and everything. So working with the chefs with this has also been amazing.
Okay, so I look forward to it. So thank you so much for joining us today, Guy.
Thank you, Akiko. It was my pleasure. I love the podcast and this was great. Let's do it again soon. I would love to talk again. Maybe next time after I get back from the next Japan trip,
we
can catch up and I can tell you a little bit about that as well.
Yeah, I'm sure our listeners want to listen to you again too. So yeah, good luck.
Thank you so much. Have a great rest of your week.
Hey, you too. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japaneats@heritageradionetwork.org or akikokatema.com. Japan Eats is a weekly program and is always available at heritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. My engineer is Anand Spanjan, and thank you for listening. I will see you next week. Japan Eats is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.